So yeah, thank you guys for coming to the first Zoom edition of the Purple Knights podcast. I'd done some video chat. I'd done a video chat before with my niece on the YouTube channel a while back, but this is the first formal interview I'm conducting via Zoom. So obviously, if you're watching this on YouTube, thank you very much. If you're listening to the audio on Blog Talk Radio or iTunes, thank you very much. I'm here with Dwayne Tudall, author of the forthcoming book, Prince and the Parade and Sign of the Times Era Studio Sessions, 1985 and 1986. So welcome, Dwayne. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Chris. It's great to be here. It's funny. It's funny to hear somebody saying the name of the book. I'm so used to hearing the name of Prince and the Purple Rain. So when I heard you say that, I was going, "Is he got the name right?" And I was like, "Oh yeah, he does."
Oh, yeah.
This is one of the first podcasts I've done for the book. So I'm really excited. So thanks. I've been waiting. I've been hoping to do this with you. Been very excited about this.
Very, very exciting. And I'm very, very honored that you chose me to be one of the first, among the first podcasts that you're doing for this book. I know that our first podcast that we did was very, very well received, and I got very warm feedback for that. So I'm very appreciative, and I'm very appreciative of our friendship as well. Let me say
Absolutely.
that right off the bat.
I was going to say the same thing. I was actually going to say the same thing. So that's why it's exciting for me because you're my friend and I enjoy our company. So this is great.
Yes, you've been very supportive with the different ideas that I've come at with you for my own personal projects, and some of those are still up in the air, but I'm getting re-inspired. I'm getting the wind underneath my sails right now, so to speak. So soon I hope to pick those back up and really hit the ground running with those, but that's for another episode entirely.
Well, tell me how I can help. I know I've always said that, but please, please, please tell me how I can help. I'm always happy to help you.
I will reach out to you most definitely when the time is right. So I very much appreciate that, and I appreciate your friendship and your encouragement. So thank you so very much. Well, where do we want to start? I mean, the most logical jumping point. I had talked before we started about starting with Elton John in the foreword, but let's back up a little bit. With the previous book, I know you're probably tired of talking about the previous book, but we'll just talk about it in terms of a transition to this new book.
Okay.
Well, it took you 20 years on and off to write the first book,
Yes.
and it took you about, what, 3.5 years
Well,
to write this one?
yeah, I mean, I was writing this one, I was researching this one while I was writing the first one. So the
Okay.
research started about 25 years ago altogether, and that included the book that came out, this book, and maybe even future books. I've been kind of compiling everything. You know, every time I find a quote by Prince or one of his band members or people that are in the room, I keep a document. I've got this document that's probably about 2,000 pages long of every song
Oh.
I've seen and every quote about it and stuff like this. So when somebody says Computer Blue, I can type in Computer Blue and it comes up with a thing of all the different pieces of information in it. So,
Oh wow, that's
yeah.
wonderful. Because I was, one of my points was going to be throughout the conversation, or as part of the conversation, take writing a book like this in 3.5 years is a Prince-like feat in and of itself. So I mean, because I mean, there's so much. He was so busy and so prolific with so many things. As I said in my review for my blog, which I'll post a link to that in the description box here if you're watching on YouTube. If you're listening on Blog Talk Radio, I'll posted to the Facebook page as well for the Purple Knights podcast. But as I said, in my review, it almost induces motion sickness reading it because there's so many things going on all at once, and it's overwhelming. But it's fascinating at the same time. Like, how could a human being do all these things simultaneously? And it's just amazing to read about. So the fact that you were able to, in your research and in your writing, break down and, you know, and separate all these things that are happening at the same time and talk about them methodically and efficiently is impressive in itself. So I just wanted to compliment you on that, because it's quite an accomplishment in and of itself to write a book as busy and as, you know, chock full of information and it's detailed as this one is.
I think that it's funny, because like I said, I've been putting this together for 25 years in some form. I've been a fan of Prince since Controversy. So all this stuff is in my head. And like most of us Prince fans, we're filled with little tidbits of stories. We all read all the articles. We all read the books that come out, or a lot of us do, the liner notes of things. And you start to put it, it's a giant puzzle, and you start to put the pieces together. When I did a first draft of this, it had all the information, the dates, but it didn't have why. I mean, it's funny, when you're doing things like this, it's easy to ask the how questions or the when questions to a certain extent, but it's the why questions that end up being more revealing. So when you ask a why question, why did you do this? Sometimes you can talk to members of the Revolution or band members. Why did Prince do this? Why did you do this? Why did it happen like this? Those are the most interesting answers, because they're revealing what's inside here. When is right. here, you right. know, how is with your hands, but why is from your heart and your head. And so when somebody reveals why they did something, why did you paint that room blue? Why did you, you know, exactly. So you understand the personal a little bit more. And that's what I wanted to do, is not only understand the music, but understand the man behind the music and why he did right. certain things. And right. again, all this stuff is speculation, because I wasn't there. And I can only go on what the people tell me, on what Prince revealed, or his lyrics, because his lyrics really, in many ways, are like a diary. And you look at some of the things right. he says in songs, and you're going, oh, okay, he's upset with somebody here. Oh, he's having a great day. Oh, he had a nice sandwich that day. You know, whatever it is, and you're going, oh, okay. And the funny thing is, he'll record two or three songs in a day. And so you almost can not just see how he was that day, but see how he was hourly. And you're going, oh, wait, he did this at this time. But then after lunch, he did this. And after dinner, he did this. And you're going, oh, okay. Well, he must have had a spicy dinner there, because he seems upset, you know, right. or whatever it is. And it reveals so much about him. But when you start putting that in context of the man's life and the people around him and relationships, I really wanted to go out of my way not to make it a book about, you know, the dirt and things like that. But I wanted to make sure that I mentioned the people that he was with that affected his music, relationships, love interests, his engagement right. with Susanna Melvoin. I mean, I want to make sure people like Susanna are really kind of these unspoken people with this. And the Revolution is really important during this era. And I think that people need to understand how important they were, because of the intimacy that he shared with these people. And so right. I've interviewed them. I was able to interview pretty much all the members of the family, except for Jerome. I interviewed all the members of Apollonia 6, and they were wonderful. Brenda, Apollonia, and even Susan Muncy was able to answer some questions. Wow. And that's just, yeah. And Apollonia introduced me to Susan Muncy, and wow. Both of them are incredibly sweet, and I'm in their debt. I'm in all the debt of all the people that helped. I look at the people that were kind enough to interview with me, and I think, you've invited me into your house, and I want to make sure I honor what they did historically and for me and this project, because I kind of wanted to write a kind of book I wanted to read. Right. I always wanted to read. I like, there's a book about the Beatles, the Beatles studio sessions, and it's really good. And there's a Beach Boys one, and the Monkees, and all these other bands, Eric Clapton. And I like reading what went on to the music. I like the personal things because it makes me go back and listen to the music again a second time, but with new ears. And you're going, I never heard that part, or I never. And now that you guys have the Sign of the Times Super Deluxe, a lot of the things that you're going to read in this book, you can look up and you can say, oh, he did that. Now I can hear that song. And I understand, you know, when the Super Deluxe came out, there was a lot of songs on there nobody knew or had heard, or even some of them nobody even knew about.
Right.
And that was kind of fun to be able to talk about some of the stuff, which people had been talking about to me for a while, but it hadn't been out there. So I love the fact that people can share in this experience and play the music and read the book and make it a, you know, a thing where you sit down like a big meal and
right.
you're like, I got my appetizer here and I got this and I'm going to dip this in that. And that's by the end of the thing, you should be like rubbing your belly like you've been at a buffet. And that's what my kind of hope is at the end of this 700 pages, you're going to say, I need a break. I've finished, you know, I want that.
Yeah.
I want people to feel like they've had a 7-course meal with a dessert and candles on their cake and blow it out and have the most amazing meal ever. That was my goal with this. So
yeah, and my immediate thought is, well, I was thinking, Altero, when you were saying all that, I don't want to undersell the first book at all because the first book was wonderful, but this book is not only physically bigger, but it's aesthetically more expansive, and there's a lot more to savor, to use your food analogy. There's a lot more to savor there, and I think it does what a good sequel should do, is takes the base of what was great about the original and really expand on that, and really expand on the environment, the characters, you know, the people involved, everything like that. And the second book two does that. And it's so extraordinary and so satisfying as a reader to, you know, read a book like that. You're almost wondering, can this be topped again? You know, not to put any pressure on you, Dwayne.
Oh, good.
But I mean, it's like you've really, really topped yourself, and I can't really understate that because it's extraordinary. Like I said, not to put any pressure on you, but just from a standpoint of a follow-up, you know, you've really outdone yourself with this.
Thank
and I was gobsmacked when I read the book. I was like, wow, this is everything that I could have expected and more from the second book in the series. So I was really
I was really
pleasantly overwhelmed by it all. But
well, I was hoping this is your reaction is you, when you do something like this, you hope you can do something better.
Yeah.
And I think I learned how to do it from the first book. The first book's always been my baby. I mean, it's my
right.
first book. So
right.
I'm always going to have a special part in my heart for the first book. What I was able to do with the second book was, once I'd established what I was doing, more people came out and more people were open to talking to me.
Right.
And I got to interview people that, you know, once I was able to give them the first book as a calling card. Here's what I do, here's what I want to do, and here's the direction I'm going to go. That's part of it. The other part is the Sign of the Times era is really filled with so many amazing stories.
Right.
And I think the fun thing to me is the book is two things. It's a reference guide, so you can sit there and go, oh, wonder what happened on my birthday. Hey, he did this on my birthday. That's kind of fun right there. I think everybody's going to look
yes.
up their birthday.
Yes.
That's the way it is. Second part is it's a linear story. And if you read it from beginning to end, it tells a story in a way that is told through his music, and it explains a lot about him. And the interesting thing about the second book is it doesn't end on a happy note like the first book did.
Right. I was going to say that, but I didn't want to spoil it.
Well, no, I'll say it. I don't mind spoiling it. Okay. People want to. My thought is, if people want to read it, they're going to read the book. I don't mind saying a few things in here. I'm not one of these authors who's going to be saying, you got to read the book, because you know, if you want to read the book, read the book. I'd love you to read the book. It would be it would mean a lot to me, because maybe I could do a third book. But I'm not going to sit here teasing people going, ooh, this is, you know. The ending of the book is – it's a little bit of a downer, because at the end of the book, he submitted Sign of the Times to Warner Brothers, or Crystal Ball to Warner Brothers. It got turned down. He had to redo it, had to reduce the album from this to that, 3 discs to 2 discs. The revolution was broken up.
Yep.
His relationship with Susanna was over.
Yep.
And he's really just in a holding pattern. And it ends with the last night of this, and he's gathering the Sign of the Times band for the very first time for a party. And so you're like going, you know that there's about to be this incredible renewal, but at the point that the end, and I didn't want to manufacture a happy ending, because this is the reality. He was in a place that was, I don't want to say dark, but a place that was contemplative, and he had to like reflect. And I think when he's good like that, he can see the way out of any situation and go there. And I think that's what happens.
When you say that, a lyric popped in my head, and I'll probably bleep this for YouTube, but Rebirth of the Flesh, he's like, this ain't cards, motherfucker, this is life.
Exactly. So, and I think exactly. And he did stuff like that. He would pepper his stuff with little things like that. There's a line in this ain't about music. This is about the music we just want. This ain't about the money we just want to play.
Right.
Saying almost a dig back at the revolution, saying, yeah, you were asking for money. This is not about money. We just want to play. Right. You know, so I think Susan Rogers, who, by the way, your interview with Susan Rogers is fantastic. And I used elements from that in the book. I just want to make sure I threw some props your way, because you had a really solid interview with her. And I used pieces from that in the book.
Thank you so much.
You asked her really good questions, really good questions. And if you haven't seen that, I was going to say stop this, but wait until the end of this one done, and then go watch that one. It's worth seeing. But stick around to the end for this one. She had said sometimes Prince could be a little bratty. And I can see that. Yes, I mean, you got to imagine the guy's 25, 26, 27 years old. Having all this money, all the fame and everything you want, and artistic freedom in a way that most artists never get, and success on a level that most artists will never, ever see.
Right.
There's going to be some times when he overextends himself or can say, you know what? I mean, there's a part where in the book where some people are talking, and I don't know if I can use these words now. You mentioned beeping some of this stuff out, but he's sitting there saying, you know, some people are talking and they're saying, you know, one of the crew members is kind of a jerk, let's just say, and he walks in. Yeah, an a-hole. And Prince walks in and says, "Who are you talking about?" And they start explaining to him, you know, one of the guys here is an a-hole. And Prince says, "Let me get this one thing straight. There's only one a-hole around here, and that's me." And it's like, and you realize, oh man, yeah, I guess that's true. I mean, he's the kind of guy that could say in the middle of the night, "I need a camel and a camera. And I want you to pick that up in the middle of the night." And his people go, oh, okay. And they'll do it. That's the thing is, you realize, and I think Peggy says this, and Susan Rogers says this, and so many Coke John Surprise says this, that when he wanted something, you found a way to do it. Or you weren't around. If you couldn't fulfill that, he found somebody who could. And that, you know, whether it's Karen Krattinger scheduling a party, you know, at a moment's notice, or whoever it is, this guy was, you know, amazing at finding the right people around him to be able to accommodate his being Prince, you know. And that's the thing is they I think the important part about a book like this is to show the people around him, because he was Prince and he would have been Prince no matter who was around him. But you see how the people around him lifted him up and took away the other responsibilities so he could be Prince. He didn't have to deal with, you know, little details like that, because they were all taken care of by him, by their friend, by the people around him. And I think that made it so that he could record at such a pace. And you were talking earlier about how much he did. And with the book, when you go through it, it is almost nauseating What you think? When did he get? What do you see? I should, really should probably just written when he slept and just had a little section in there. Here's a line from where he slept 3 hours, because you just the whole first chapter. Their chapters are by month. You read the whole first chapter. You can see that he was recording. He was on the road, and then recording his own stuff and Sheila's stuff, and then sound checks, and you're just going, "Oh my God, this guy just does not stop. He does not
No,
stop." And
no.
it's mind-numbing how busy that guy was, and it's kind of cool. But
Yeah.
so that's the fun thing to me is seeing how detailed his life was, and how busy, and how much not just music came out of him, but how much great music came out of him.
Right. A personal story from my life recently. I go to therapy every week. Well, now it's virtual, but I have therapy sessions every week, and I showed my therapist my review that I wrote for the book, and I talked to her quite a bit about Prince and Prince's influence in on my life, and I said something to the effect that I try to emulate or work toward the sort of level of inspiration and the work ethic that Prince had. I tried to aspire to that, but and she stopped me in the middle of the sentence and said, "Yeah, but Prince was far from a normal person. He was almost superhuman in some ways. So to try to aspire to that is like trying to, find a needle in a haystack or something. It's
No, I agree. It's funny because my wife has said to me, "You're don't try to be like Prince when it comes to your work,"
Right.
and like you were saying, I mean, I certainly wouldn't compare myself to Prince in any way,
Neither would I. I would
other than we use the
neither.
same words and the same language. But
Right.
yeah, I he's a genius. Time wise, when you're writing a book like this, it is every day, every night, every weekend, every holiday, and so that's what you do. And my wife and daughter are very understanding about the fact that literally, as soon as we're done eating, I go downstairs. I haven't watched TV for about a year or two, for the most part, unless it's like unless I'm done and I cannot do anything. My wrists are messed up. I wear wristbands because I've destroyed my arms from here to here, because I'm
Yeah.
always writing.
Yeah.
It is, and you and I have talked about this. It's
Yeah.
privately because
Yeah.
it's. To write, it has to come from here, and you have to bleed. You kind of have to. And I think about how much he worked, and I kept thinking, somebody asked me one time, "Why do I write about Prince?" And I was like, "When you know these kind of stories, why? How can you not? How can you not
Right.
want to share cool stories with people?" Because I've
Right.
gotten so much out of being a fan, and how much of being, somebody who's watched him. If I can give back just a little bit of my time and my energy to his legacy. I'm 57 now, and that was where Prince made it to,
Yeah.
and you go, wow, I don't know how I don't know how he had that energy, because I get burned out, but yet you
Yeah.
still see him go, and you're just going, wow, that guy just, it's a there's a funny story in the book about how good he was with instruments, that Susan Moonsey tells, about she gives him an at a steel drum, and she found this thing. She says, "This is an instrument he's never used. I can't
Yep.
wait to see him try to learn it and stuff like this." And he sits down, he gets he unwraps it, and she's like, "You like it? You like it? You're gonna take a while to learn it, right?" And he gets grabs the sticks and goes, and starts playing it perfectly. And she goes, "Wait, oh, that's right, you're Prince." And I just thought
Right.
that to me is so funny, because it's like, how on earth did he know specifically how to do stuff like that, and yet it was in him. And I think that people forget that on top of all that work that he did, he also played and practiced and did all that stuff to prep for everything. So rehearsals, he would rehearse in front of the mirror and learn spins. That's why we didn't watch him with a guitar. He's like so fluid because he spent so much time making it right, and he did that. So he would look good on stage, but that was for you, the viewer, and the people who are paying to see him. He
Right.
understood that he wanted to give this, and he didn't want to just go out there and ripped up jeans and just bang around a little bit. He would make it so that what he's giving you is something he's already perfected in private. And that, I think, is something that gets lost until you start to see how much the man did. And you hear from all the people, the engineers, band members, singers, managers, studio executives, all these people that were involved in these sessions. I think I interviewed about close to 50 people that were involved in these sessions. And you
Right.
sit there going, you know, in some of these interviews, I had like Al Magnoli and I talked for like 8 hours. Susan Malfoy and I have spoken for, I don't know, probably about 25, 30 hours over time.
Wow. Yeah.
Anyway, Wendy and Lisa and I have spent time together. Each one of these people, and the nice thing is, Susan Rogers, another person, I've flown across the country to have lunch with her, because I wanted to make that connection. And
Right.
you find that these people are open to telling the stories if they're being done respectfully. And that's the
Right.
nice thing is if you were telling the story in a respectful way. And granted, there's times in the book that Prince comes off as a little bit of a brat. It's
Oh,
like,
yeah.
okay,
Yeah.
but you also see in context why and understand that the pressure this guy was under, and you go, oh my gosh. And I think that's one of the things important is because a revolution breaks up in the book. And I don't think I'm giving anything away by telling that.
Right.
But you have to see that there's tension there. And you can't
Right.
just have a story that has happy, 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 happy breakup. You have to find why they're doing this. And it's all part of how the music was created. Not throwing shade on anybody, it's telling the story with authenticity and truth as much as possible. And I think that's important. I don't want to make him into a godlike figure. I wanted to
Right.
make sure people understood this is a man, a genius, who worked harder than almost anybody you'll ever meet. But he also at times struggled at certain things. He wasn't really social. He wasn't really, and people talk about that. And it's funny because you mentioned the Elton John intro, the foreword. Part of that is in there. The first thing that happens in the intro or the foreword is Elton John walks up to Prince and says, "Hi, my name's Elton John. I would like to meet you." And Prince goes, and just walks away. And you're like, "Oh my God." You walked away from Elton John, who's one of the biggest musicians of my lifetime. And he just kind of, and Elton was like, okay. And he accepted that because he understood. Susan Rogers talks about that in the book, and other people talk about how he wasn't a social creature. He's told his talk, he talked his stories through his music. And often he was socially awkward and didn't always understand how to deal with people at certain levels. And we all put a certain image of what he's like in our heads, but we're imagining it. They're actually telling the story. And they're the people that knew him and loved him and had a closeness to this man are actually talking about them. And that is, I so many of these things, when I was sitting there interviewing people, I could sit there and just go, you know, listening to the stories and I'm thinking, how do I put this in place in the things? And when you finally start to see the puzzle pieces put together, there's a magic to it that's revealed. It's like all these things unlocking, and it just opens up, and you're going, "Oh my gosh, now I see it a little bit more in perspective." And I guarantee you, somebody's going to write another book that has information that I've never even known about, and I welcome that, and I look forward to that because, as much of a writer as I am, I'm a fan of this stuff even more, and I want to know more. I love when Mark Brown writes a book, or you know, I want Wendy and Lisa to write books. I want Dr. Fink to write a book. I want, you know, I enjoyed Morris Day's book. I love this stuff. Bring it, bring it, bring it. You know. So that's
Yeah,
me.
I love it too. And the way you were talking about, telling the story of the man behind the music, in my review that I wrote for my blog, I talk about the fact that I really appreciate that this book, more so than the first book, really gets into the psychology of, the pressure Prince was facing and the superstar persona versus the real man, the superstar persona of Prince versus, Prince, the regular guy. And there's a great quote in there from Lisa that says something to the effect that I think it was hard for him to decide when he could be, when he had to be Prince the superstar versus Prince the guy. And because he gave himself so fully to the superstar persona. And that's what I mean when this book, when I say this book is more psychologically in depth and more psychologically charged, is it really gives you a picture of what's inside Prince's head, you know, his motivations, his fears, his goals. You know, it really gives you quite a deep picture of all of that. And I didn't mean to say it in a negative sense, but I got feedback from somebody, virtually the only negative feedback I've received so far. They were like, oh, here we go. You know, more armchair psychologists who think they knew Prince and knew what he was about. And I'm not sure I want to get this book. And I was like, oh my God, that's not what I meant at all.
Here's the thing.
And that's not what you meant either, Dwayne, as the author. It's just, it's so unfortunate how things get misconstrued and misunderstood. You know, but
I got a thick skin about a lot of this stuff, mostly. But I saw that comment and I thought about this. And if you're not going to get the stories from those who knew him best, where are you going to get the stories? And that's the thing I go to with this. I quote Princess a lot in the book. I mean, you see, I made sure what I did, in if you haven't read either books, all of Prince's quotes are in bold. So that way,
wonderful. It's an excellent, wonderful approach. I just love it.
Thank you.
I love it.
It makes it so when you're looking for it, you go, oh, Prince said that. Okay, great.
Yes.
And Prince had a way of saying things sometimes to throw you off track too. I mean, he would say, right, look over here and then run this way. You know, that he would do that for a guy that is that confident to be revealing that he's a little nervous. It's kind of nice. And people seriously do forget that he was a human. And the people that know him best are the people around him. And I'm for the most part, I don't speculate on anything. I don't really talk about whether this song is great, whether the song is not. I try not to, because this book is not about me. My thought is, as few words as I can put in between quotes, I'm happier, because I'll step back and let these people talk, because the most fun thing to me is when you hear them talking. There's a great story in there, great, I think, about them recording the song Splash. And Susan Rogers says, okay, there's a lyric in the song Splash, and that he got the thing about the, I forget the word, is the wintergreen or whatever it is. But she had that, like, wintergreen Tic Tacs or something like that, or gum, in her purse. And she's like, you went right into my purse. You found that. And I think that's so funny, because then you start hearing that. Then it comes into a quote from Wendy saying, yeah, that's typical Prince. He would do that. And you hear Lisa saying, yeah, we were teasing about that. Yeah, and we're singing a gum commercial. He's like, shut up and just sing. And to me, when you hear that kind of stuff, you hear the joy that these people had and the closeness and the intimacy they shared in a way that I don't think he always allowed out. And I think that that part of the thing is what makes the book fun. I'll tell you, there's times – it's a 700-page book. So when I'm going through proofreading it, by the time I get to the end, there's certain things I may have forgotten. Not forgotten, but you know, you kind of – you can only keep so much in your brain, especially my brain.
Yeah, it's sort of glossed over.
Yeah. And so I go back as I'm reading through and going, oh, that's a good point. You know, and I'm laughing going, oh, my God, that's a nice little story. In context, sometimes I once I finished it, I spent 2 weeks away from it. Then I went back and proofread it. And I was like, ooh, I forgot about some of these. There's stories in there. There's a great story that Alan Leeds tells about after the Purple Rain tour. They went on, Rio and to go to the beach. And he has a story about Prince going to the beach. And they went to the beach. And the next day, Prince said, okay, what are we doing? They said, we're going to the beach again. He goes, nope, done it. I'm going home. And you're like, I'm going to go on vacation for 2 days. And then you have a quote from David Leonard saying, I was in a club 3 days after the tour ended. I look over and Prince is standing next to me. I thought you were at Rio. And he's like, yeah, I got bored. And I'm like, but when you hear those kind of things, it's fun to – the best stories are ones that get told and then people adding to the story. So you get a full context in of the tale. And I love, it's like being in a conversation with a bunch of friends and they say, you know what happened after you left the room? Well, this is what happened. And they go, I'll tell you what happened when I drove him home that night. It's all those things making a big goulash that you just store together, a big gumbo, you know, and that to me is the fun thing for this. So.
Speaking of stories, the one that sticks out to me, the one that I really loved, that really made me laugh, was about the stuffed penguin that's actually credited as one of the background singers for Housequake. That story is great, and I still wish they would have gotten Prince when they tried to get him, but of course, you know, he was like, don't even try it.
Yeah,
So,
for, so people understand what the story is there was a penguin, the stuffed penguin that they were using that was in the studio, and they would take pictures of people with it. If you fell asleep, they'd get a picture of you with the penguin, and they kept all these pictures, and they kept trying to get Prince to do this, and crying, and finally they snuck in, got him, and he had his head down, and he lifts his head up and says, "Don't even try it." You know, and he's like, you're not gonna get him over on him. And you're right, that is those kind of stories to me are Prince the man, as
Right.
opposed to Prince the superstar, which is all you and I would ever know is Prince the superstar. We
Right.
know, and that's why it's very poignant to me on top of that, because of all the people I interviewed, they all dealt with the loss of a friend.
Right.
Whereas we deal with the loss of an icon, a guy who brought us music, guy we go to see in concert, the guy, whatever it was, but we were always one removed at least.
Right.
We were never on stage. So when you can talk to the people that stood next to him on stage and find out what he did before he went on stage, after he went on stage, that night on the bus, down the plane, you go, oh, okay, I kind of get a little bit more about why this guy was so revered by other musicians, by fans, and by critics. You don't get many people, musicians, that get that. You have mostly
Right.
ones that have two of the three. But rarely ever do you get all three. You get the whole stool that can stand there, but
Yeah.
you rarely ever get that. And there's not a lot of performers that have all three of those in his in the amount that he has. And that's
Right.
why I think, you know, there's nobody like him. There will be nobody that is like him. We'll have other musicians we love, but there will not be. There's a reason why Elton John wanted to write a foreword for this. And it wasn't me. I'll tell you that. It wasn't me. He read the book. He read the book before he wrote the foreword. Let me give you some background on that because I love this story. I'm insanely proud that Elton John wrote the foreword for this book. But
Oh
again, I
yeah,
know what I know it
definitely.
wasn't. I know it wasn't about me. I know this. About a year ago, Elton John did a fundraiser on TV for the WHO, and we're watching this, and my wife and I are watching this, and I said to her, "Wouldn't it be cool if Elton John wrote the foreword?" And we started laughing because, you know, that's like shooting past the moon, and we were laughing about that. The next day, a friend of mine named Matthew Bitone reached out to me and said, "How do you feel about Elton John writing a foreword to your book?" Now, Matthew, I've known since the '90s, early '90s. We've been friends since Diamonds and Pearls, and isn't it funny how we date things by album, you know?
Yes.
Oh, we were friends since
Yes.
Diamonds and Pearls. And everybody knows that. Oh, that must be 1990, 1991. But he said, "But how do you feel about that?" I said, "Yeah, I think it'd be, obviously that'd be really cool." And so from March of last year until January of this year, we were working on it. And I literally did not seek out somebody else besides that after that, because I thought that's plan A. I don't want to spend any time on plan B. So back in September, I sent him a copy of the book, an early draft of it. They were looking at it. We were going through all this stuff, and we didn't know. I mean, literally, I was getting to the point where I have to deliver the book, and I didn't have a forward. And I thought, well, you know what? You shoot for it, and sometimes you miss. And then I got an email from Matthew who said, "Read this," and it was submitted to us. And it made me cry. I literally walked up to my wife, and I said, I started reading it, and tears going down my face. Because I first of the joy of this, second of it's so poignant and so touching to hear an international superstar on the level, even above Prince in many ways of sales and stuff like this. I didn't realize Elton John sold like 300 million albums. That's a lot, you know. And yeah, that's a lot. And so for him to do that, it blew my mind, because I look at the cover of the book and it has Prince, Elton John, Dwayne Tudal. And I'm laughing, going, you know, one of these things is not like the other. You know, and so it's like, it's insanely cool. I'm in debt to for the rest of my life. And Elton John as well, all the people around him, his husband, everybody that was involved with that, I cannot thank them more, you know, enough. I could literally be sitting there saying, thank you, thank you, thank you, until the day I keel. And I still would say, ah, missed it. Didn't get enough thank yous in there. Because
Yeah.
that's how grateful I feel about this, you know,
Yeah.
so.
Yeah. And one thing I wanted to tell you too, reading the book and finding out more about what Prince was like personally and Prince the man, it gave me some much needed closure that I've needed since Prince's passing, because ever since I was around 12 years old, this would be the Love Symbol, Love Symbol album, 92.
So you're born in like 1980. You're born
Yes,
around controversy and dirty
I'm a
mind.
dirty mind
I
baby.
was gonna
Yeah,
say, you're dirty mind baby.
yeah.
So funny.
So, ever since I was 12 years old, I had the dream to sit with Prince and have a discussion with him. Sort of like we're having now, but on obviously on much deeper things like inspiration, hope, perseverance, work ethic, most of all God. And I just wanted to tell him my story and personally interact with him and be you know have my story be acknowledged by my hero. And I know Prince hated the concept of idol worship and all that, but I've got to be true to myself and true to my words. And he was literally, for me, and still is, a hero.
I agree with that. Yeah.
So I always carried with me this hope or this aspiration to sit down with him and talk, you know, like to, you know, not you know, fan to superstar or anything like that sort of dynamic, but just two creative people, two sensitive guys that just loved music and loved people and loved God. And I always had the hope and the expectation of that happening in my life, and the closest I got to it was July 26, 2014, at Paisley Park. Candace Springs, who's a jazz keyboardist, originally based out of Nashville, was Prince's guest that evening, and she was playing a set with, I believe it was John Blackwell on drums and Andrew Goucher on bass. And I know I'm forgetting somebody in there, but, and she was on keys and vocals.
Wow.
And I was at the right side of the room, close to the wall. And Prince was up against the wall playing a cabasa. And Dwayne, I don't know if you know what that is. It's an instrument similar to a maraca. It's kind of a percussion instrument, a shaker, like you hold it in one hand and manipulate it.
Yeah, I didn't think you were thinking about the meat kielbasa.
Yeah, no, not the sausage, but the actual
Yes,
percussion
yes,
instrument. But
yes.
yeah, so he was playing that, just enjoying himself. And I was thinking to myself, you know, I was watching him because he was, you know, a few feet away, and I was watching him, and I was thinking, wow, I wonder if he possibly see me and come over and talk to me. And you know, I just had that fleeting thought in my head, like, wow, I wonder if this could happen. And just as I was thinking that, in my peripheral vision, I saw Prince take notice of me, and all of a sudden float. He didn't walk, he floated. he floated over to me and was 2 feet in front of me, or maybe even less. My depth perception and everything else was totally off in that moment. I mean, I was just totally lost to any of my faculties, but he was standing in front of me offering me the kielbasa, and I only realized in hindsight that he was actually offering it for me to keep as a keepsake, as a memory. In the moment, I thought he was just offering it for me to, you know, to play a little bit and then hand it back. But people told me after the fact, they were like, no, he was giving it to you. And I was like, oh man. No, what a regret. But I'm so self-conscious about my body having cerebral palsy and the way my fine motor skills are affected and the way my hands don't work as well as I'd like them to, that my mind was racing a mile a minute. And I was thinking, do I really want to risk trying to take this instrument and look awkward or look clunky in front of Prince trying to play this thing? So I just sat there, and as all these thoughts were racing into my mind, you know, what do I say? What do I do? I was just sitting there grinning like an idiot. And Prince was smiling back at me like, hey, you know, good to see you. I love your smile. And, you know, but he didn't say a word. It was all nonverbal.
Wow.
And I was thinking, you know, should I try and talk to him? Shouldn't I? You know, it's like the lyric from Joy and Repetition. Should I try to rap to her? Should I stand and stare? You know, it was all these thoughts going through my head. And I realized that, you know, the music was going on. The performance was going on. Candace Springs and the other musicians were playing. So the music was quite loud. And I'm like, I tell myself, you know, I can't yell over the music to Prince, you know, and scare him off like he would be like a deer in the headlights, you know, and his eyes would go, you know, as big as saucers, and he would take off, you know. So I was like, in my head, I was like, I can't risk that. So I just sat there and smiled at him. Then my sister Paula, who I believe you've met, mm-hmm. She was with me at the Prince for Minneapolis Symposium,
right,
along with my mom. Fairness.
Very, I like them both, yes.
And she was sitting behind me, and so I looked in Paula's direction, like, and I didn't say anything, but it was a look like, you know, what do I do? What do I do next? And Prince caught that, and his gaze shifted to Paula, and Paula was like, you know, she was absolutely, you know, gobsmacked. She forgot her name. She forgot how to speak, how to form words. So it was like, you know, she sat there and stared at Prince. And this, all of the story that I'm telling transpired within a moment of like 20 seconds, 15 right. to 20 seconds. And it's like, so Prince is looking at my sister. My sister is doing nothing. He looks at her for a few seconds and then shrugs his shoulders lightly and walks away. So that was it. So
I probably would have done the same thing, though. Prince is handing you something. I'd probably been like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say.
Yeah.
I think all of us have a conversation in our head we expect to have with him. Then the reality, which you got much closer than I ever did, the reality is like, I messed that up. That was nothing. Like it's like meeting, you know, it is. It's meeting somebody that you've thought about the conversation we'd have many times. We'd sit right. down, we'd rap, and go, oh, no, I guess not.
Right. But so, yeah. But I always have that memory. And going back to your book, reading about how non-social he was and how socially awkward he was gave me a sense of closure, because I was like, even if I would have had that opportunity, it probably wouldn't have lived up to my expectations and what I had built in my mind, because Prince wasn't a, you know, he wasn't a social person. He could communicate non-verbally. He could communicate through his music. But, you know, as far as socially, you know, sitting there having deep conversations, which he has done with bandmates and stuff,
sure,
like
sure.
I know about that, people that he was, you know, really close to, wasn't really the norm for him. So reading about that and that quality that he had sort of gave me the closure that I needed to sort of move on and heal from that regret of not being able to have that conversation. So I just want to thank you for that.
Thank you.
For the closure.
Wow. That's a heavy thing. Wow. Thank you.
The closure that you gave me and sort of the peace that you restored to my heart, to my soul. So.
Wow, Chris, you've never told me this. And we've talked many times, many late nights we've been on the computer together.
Yeah.
And I had no idea about this. I knew the story because we've talked about it privately.
But yeah.
Man, this is why I say you got to write a book, man. That's, you know, and every time I talk to you, I probably say the same thing. I'm a broken record. You know, right. If I can write it, anybody can write it. Trust me. Trust me.
Not to harp on myself, but that's the main reason, the main thrust of why I want to write a book, because I want to have that, if only in a symbolic sense, I want to have that conversation with Prince that I never got to have. So
right.
The book itself, you know, to sound selfish, but it really is, deep down it's selfish, but it's a way for me to have the conversation with Prince that I always dreamed about and that I always aspired to. And I told my therapist again, to get back to that, I told her, you know, it really shouldn't matter to me what anybody else thinks or how it's going to be received. Of course, I want the book to be received well, and I want it to impact people, and I want people to see my story and be touched, be moved, be motivated to sort of look within themselves and reach their higher self, like I have been able to through being a fan of Prince so many years and following the example that he not only set through his music, but also through his behavior, you know, stuff like asserting his independence in the whole slave era, mm-hmm. and, you know, speaking up for artists' rights and stuff like that. That's a level of confidence and a level of independence that I aspire to, and I want to tell my story for that reason as well, to maybe uplift somebody or motivate somebody to tap into their own spirituality and their own personal power, personal confidence. But I mainly want to tell the story just to talk to Prince and say, hey Prince, I'm finally talking to you. I'm telling you my story. I'm living out something that I've dreamed of living out since I was 12 years old. And it's all for you, for love of you and your work.
And let me add something. Can I add something? Let me add something to that. You had mentioned that you were worried about it. Not necessarily worried, but you felt like writing the book would be a little bit of a selfish thing. And I hadn't thought about this before, but actually writing a book is a selfish thing in some ways. I mean, it's a giving thing,
right.
But there's a certain selfish thing to it, because I'm writing a book and thinking, I would like you to buy this or go to the library and spend a week or two reading my thoughts. Right. And so any book or any record or anything like this, it's a bit of selfishness to it. Even putting on a concert, I'm going to go on stage and I'm going to sing a song that I wrote myself, and I want you to be out there. I want you to pay me to come see this. So there's a certain aspect of any sort of artistic endeavor, art. I painted a picture. Yeah, paint. I didn't paint that, but the guy that painted that thought somebody's going to pay me money to do this. I'm incredibly, you know, and I don't even notice that picture now. But it's one of these things that it's, there's a selfishness about art, but there's also a giving thing about art. And I think that's what the angle that to take is. There are people, like you said, who will hear your story, or in my case, hear the stories of the people around Prince and Prince that will be inspired. And there's artists out there, and there's people that you know that will hear and take little kernels. That I read almost every book I read, I find a piece in it that I can take with me. And sometimes it's a scary book or a historical book. I've read, you know, I like historical books, Wright Brothers, you know. Teddy Roosevelt. I like books like that. And so when I see those and I'm able to be in the room with them, I feel like I know them better and I understand their decisions. And when you know the person better, whether it's Prince or you or whoever it is, there's a nugget you can take away from it. I just watched a documentary about Mr. Rogers. And it's a great documentary. And they talk about his weight was 143 every time, his whole life or most of his adult life. And he said the reason why he wanted to maintain that was because 143 meant I love you. And it was his way of expressing that. And I thought, oh, my God, that's a fascinating way to think about his weight being 143, I love you. I thought, oh, my God, I would never have thought of that. But this is his piece. And I took that with me. So. I like that kind of stuff. And I'm hoping that there's stories like that in this book where you sit there going, oh, that's what he means by that. That's why he said this. That's why, you know, the song says this or and there's times that you go, okay, he's just in the studio jamming. And there's other times that he's in the studio telling and conveying and letting it bleed onto tape so he can, he would do a song sometimes that he would take a song just to record it, just so he could hand it to somebody. Just say, this is what I'm thinking. This is where I am at the moment. And that had to be incredibly difficult and at the same time, incredibly important when he did that. I mean, there's a part where he talks about that in this book where he recorded Empty Room. And it was at Bobby and Vicky's wedding reception. And in the middle of that, he and Susanna were fighting. And he says, band meeting, we're going back in the studio to record. And they're like, what? This is a big day. And he had them all record Empty Room. And it was because he was breaking up in his heart with Susanna. They were struggling. And then he wanted to just give her the tape. And I'm like, it was that important. But you could see how that could be seen as selfish a little bit. But it was also his way of giving art. So I would say that... to think of things as selfish, I get it, but it is also a matter of giving. Artists give and mostly selflessly, but there's a selfish aspect to it. So, but when you see that he do that stuff, you realize, oh my God, this guy's a person and he's not a God, infallible, deity. Right. He is a guy who would, you know, if he made mistakes, he made them in private. You know, that was when he recorded. Right. I think Susan Rogers says that when he's recording, he would record by himself so that if he made a mistake, he'd erase it without an audience. And you go, oh, okay, I got it. That's why he would drill the band, make them so that you got to do this. And then he'd perform with them, but they were tight. You know, you listen to songs like Soul Psychedelicide and you go, oh, it's him drilling the band. Good, learn this. And it's probably not that much fun for the band. You know, when they're talking about being for 8-9 hours, and I think Brown Mark says you go out and get a sandwich, you know, walk, still be playing bass and walk up and grab a sandwich and be eating that while he's playing because it's just rehearsal would last so long. Yeah. Or I think Wendy or Lisa were saying, you know, how he would sometimes just get into a loop for 2 hours where he's just working on his dance moves. And you're like, oh, okay. And they're just doing, you know, three or four, you know, stanzas or, you know, bars of it. And you're going, oh, okay, that's why he did that. Because he just wanted to get into a deep groove and then just sit there and go. And then when you get – the cool thing about Prince, and you know this, one of the fun things for me is when he get into a groove that might be based on this song, it morphs into another song. And you're going, all of a sudden you start hearing this new thing come to life, you know, and he's breathing life in this, and the band is feeding it, and it's getting it's adding, you know, spices and all this stuff. And by the end, it's like this different groove, and you're going, Oh my God. And you're sitting there going, I can't stop moving. I can't, my head, everything about me is just wants to dance. And I'm still sitting there in my chair going, I don't want to dance yet. But you just, it is infectious. And
Yes.
it's one of these things, it's tough to explain to somebody because you can just do a groove and just let it sit, or you can do a groove and add some chicken grease and things like that. And all of a sudden it's this new thing. And the Revolution was so good at that. And New Power Generation, everybody's, he found ways to work with every group of people he's with. And
Right.
that I think is the important thing is people ask me why I'm focusing on the Revolution. Well, the Revolution was the band at that time and they were perfect for where they were. And then the Sign of the Times band was perfect for where they were. And Love Sexy band was perfect for, it's, he found a way to incorporate these people into what he did. And
Right.
this is sort of their story of how he would accommodate this person's skills, this person's weakness into his thing. And unbelievable that he could do a tour in, I think the tour in 82, which is the 1999, Purple Rain, Parade, Sign of the Times, and Love Sexy, all very different tours, some with different people. I don't know if the same
Right.
group was in any of those tours. I think he had different people in every one, at least somebody different. Tours with different stage, different running, different songs, different everything. And
Different style, different aesthetic.
everything. Yeah, and that's all within 5, 6 years to do
Yeah.
five major tours on top of all those albums. And you just go, oh my God, how on earth did this guy do this? You know,
Yeah.
it's a beautiful thing because you see that he wouldn't let, I've gone to see bands and you see him once and you see him 3 years later, same show, same show. Prince, you can see the next night as a different show. And
Yeah.
that's that when you think about what this guy did. And that's why, like, you or I could go to and listen to every show on a tour and still be excited about it.
Right.
That doesn't happen with a lot of artists. You don't get many artists. Bruce Springsteen does that, other people do that. Grateful Dead probably does that. But you don't get a lot of artists that literally put it all at risk on stage that night and then change it the next night and do it again. They're taking this huge chance and the trust he has in not only himself, but the people he's chosen to share the stage with him. And he
Right.
did. If you're on stage with Prince, there's a reason why you're on stage with Prince. And
Right.
that's the way it is, you know. So,
Right.
you know.
Right. And I think the book communicates all that in a way that's captivating, that's fascinating, and that just keeps you wanting more. So I'm the book isn't even out yet. I've already read it, and I feel like Prince in a way, like okay, I've done this. It isn't out yet, but I'm already moving on to the next thing in my
Please
in mentally in my
stop.
head, you know. And it's
Please.
like, okay, so what's next? But yeah, I'm just saying that sort of in jest, of course. But
Do you want to know what's next?
yes.
You don't like surprises. To quote Prince, I'm toying with the idea of doing another book, and I've already started drafting it together for. It would either be like 87, 88, or 87, 88, 89. I'm not sure what. So it'd be Sign of the Times Tour, Love Sexy, Black Album, and that would be one. Or I might add Batman in there. I'm not sure what. It depends on.
Oh,
I'll know as I'm writing it. You know, it's going to
yeah.
be. It literally takes about 2 or 3 years to really get something. And even with this, I'm like going, I wish I would have had another month on it because there's a few little things I look at and go, ooh, I had that, you know,
Yeah.
just a little typo there or little things. But it's a quarter of a million words. You know, there's going to
Yeah.
be an occasional time that this word went here, or
Right,
this, you
right.
know, like there's a one or two things I'm going, it's painful because I have friends that read it now and go, ooh, you know, you this it should be this, and I'm going, oh, but in the context of the entire book. There's a story and a truth
Right.
and a fact-based thing that I try to maintain. But I would like to do another one, but I also would like to take a week off if that's okay,
Yeah,
Chris. But
definitely
yeah.
go to Rio and stay there for 2 days and
For
then
2 days.
get bored and come back.
Exactly. Yeah, I like doing the books. I one of the coolest things is all the people I get to meet. Not just the people that did that, but that were there, because it's fun getting to know the revolution or the time or the family or things like this. What's also fun to me is getting to know you and getting to know people when we go to celebration. I'm sad that there wasn't a celebration this year and last year, because I miss seeing people like you. I miss going to these events and hanging out and seeing people and getting a chance to talk in a way that's relaxed and people coming up and saying, I really like this, or, you know, just being able to talk to somebody about music and somebody, you know, when you're talking to somebody who's big on this, they'll throw a reference out to a B-side, a lyric from a B-side. Like I heard the cymbal, or not cymbal, a siren a few minutes ago, and I was thinking, better call the law, you know, or things like this, that you're all of a sudden you start laughing to yourself going, you would get that. A lot of people watching this would get that. But there's a language that's not spoken, that's spoken in our family that we get. Right. And it's cool being around that kind of love, understanding, acceptance, and non-judgment. And I can go into a room, and I've said this before, but I can go into a room of Prince fans and know that I've got 75% in common with them. We might disagree on politics. We might disagree on world events. We might disagree on anything, but we have this basis that we want to jam with this, and we want to extend his legacy, and we are united in this. And the sad thing right now is all of us are going through, still, this is 5 years on that he's passed, almost all of us are still in the grieving stage, in the denial stage. We're still to the point where if he came out tomorrow and said, Prince was dead, I'm back, and we'd all be like, I knew it. Because in our hearts, we haven't yet said, I accept that he's gone. And I haven't. And I think, I don't know if I've met a Prince fan, a hardcore Prince fan, that is, can honestly say, I've accepted this, because I have. And it's tough, because to walk around with holding the weight of this sometimes is very tough. And it's one of these things you can't talk to about people that aren't Prince fans, because they'll go, all right, you know, get over it. And you're like, no, right now I don't want to, and I can't. And so it's something we all share.
That's basically what my dad was like about a week after he passed. I was still breaking down crying, and he was like, get over it, you know.
Exactly, it's like, exactly.
It's like, you don't understand. It's
like, this guy spoke to me. Yeah, no, it's exact. And I think that that's one of the things that unites all of us. And when we go to celebration and things like this, it's there's a connection that we all are thinking we should be wearing black still, because there's a feeling of being around people that not only want to celebrate him and not mourn him, but celebrate him and extend what he did. It's, he did the work. Now it's time for us to do the lifting that he can't do. And so we turn people on to music all the time. I got an 11-year-old daughter that I'm playing, you know, she loves Manic Monday, but she's like, Dad, I'll never like Prince like you do. I'm like, Monday you'll be writing books, honey, you know. And so it's that kind of stuff. And the fun thing is, I actually, on each cover of my book, I have a little thing where I have my daughter's name, really small,
really tiny.
And so that she can look at these books for years and go, there's my name. And I like doing that. And oh, by the way, the covers of these books, I want to say this, a guy named Rev is honestly one of the most talented guys I could ever dream of doing this kind of stuff. His work is always exciting. I mean, every time I think the first book, I thought, oh my God, I'm not going to top this. Second book, I was like, oh my God. And we, you know, we'll go back and forth. I'll give him a picture. We'll bounce ideas off each other. And it's so good. And the same with people that I have that I want to make sure I mention this, the people that I have that help me with the book when it comes to research. I have Yost and Cam and Thomas and Dee and D'Angela and Scott. It's just, these guys are, and Craig, these are all guys, their names are in the book. These are people that every week I talk to, sometimes several times a day when it comes to these things. They've read the book many times, trying to find the facts and trying to make sure that, because I only know so much. I mean, I have to admit, I know some cool things, but this is like the guy that, you know, people work on Prince Vault and things like that, that are, you know, that literally give me their time to make these things right. And in the context of life, you want to make sure that you get these things right, because if it honors him to work as hard as you can. Not everything's gonna be right. You know, you're gonna have little things that somebody says, "I don't remember that," or whatever, but you really try so hard to make sure you catch it. And I think that's important. So I'm always grateful to everybody that's helped on these books, because it could not be, I happen to be on the cover. That doesn't mean that I did everything. And
Right.
that's important to me, that people understand this, because these things are proofread and gone over. And sometimes they'll point things out to me. I'm going, "Oh my God, how did I miss that? How did I,
Yeah.
how, you know," because we all know this much, but you get everybody together, you know that much. And
Right.
so that's where I am with this stuff. So
Right.
I'm grateful if people, enjoy it. I'm hoping I can do a third one. I hope people like it. I hope people walk away with a new appreciation of him about the music, and they go and find this music, they go and buy this music, they go and seek it out, dust off their old dust off their old albums and play their 45s, and or go to YouTube and find this stuff, or find wherever it is, because
Right.
this stuff is not, it's not that it was vital. This stuff is vital. And that's the thing, is it needs to maintain. And one other thing is, every time Prince comes out with anything, even if 5 years after he's gone, how many big events have we had since then? 1999 album, Sign of the Times album, Welcome to America this summer. There's a lot that we're now discovering that
Right.
is, that should be known. And how many times do you see Prince on the cover of a magazine? Every year. You know,
Yep.
Uncut magazine has him on the cover at least once a year. He's not the only, there's only 12 rock stars, but he's on the cover almost every year. Rolling Stone gets him on the cover. All these things. It's like, wait a second, how on earth do you get a guy that 5 years after his passing, he's still on the cover of these things every year? And the things he
Yeah.
does is still a big event, newsworthy, magazine worthy, book worthy. 60 Minutes just a story about him.
Yeah.
And it's a great story. And you
Yeah.
look at this and you go, that's him. That's the legacy of Prince. And the legacy of Prince is all here with us, but we're all discovering it too. We're all passionate, and
Right.
there's so much to him and so much music to him. It's impossible to get it all in, period.
Right. Right. Two things I wanted to talk about before I let you go.
Sure.
One of them is, and I'll be talking about this on the next podcast that I do. I'm doing a podcast with Kristen Schaumler. I hope I'm pronouncing her name right. She's a historian. She used to work for the Minnesota Department of Transportation,
Okay.
and she's done a lot of work about designating historic sites around the Minneapolis and suburbs that Prince was involved with, and drawing attention to those. And she's one of the organizers of the Prince 78 to 88 academic
Oh, okay.
conference that's coming up in June.
Are you in that?
And no, but I know you're a part of it. I wasn't able to get in a submission in time, but I'm hoping to participate in future events like that, because academia surrounding Prince really excites me and really makes me appreciative of the work that so many really talented,
Absolutely,
gifted people
absolutely.
and researchers are putting out there. And if I could, lend my voice to a small corner of that, that's very gratifying for me as well.
Right.
So I love Prince Academia in general, and I'll be talking with Kristen in about a week or two.
That's great.
So look forward to that. I don't know if you wanted to tell them a little bit about your presentation that you'll be doing at the
No,
conference.
not a word, not a word.
Okay.
No, I'm kidding, I'm kidding. I haven't written it yet. I haven't written it yet.
Okay.
I was walking around today, thinking in my head, what can I do? Because I originally was going to do something where I videotape something. I'm like, I gotta talk. I just realized about a week ago, I got to talk for 20 minutes. I'm like, I mean, obviously I talk. You can see that I'm a talker.
Right.
And I talk fast, so I'll probably go through the script very quickly. Like, oh my God, this was the last 20 minutes. It's been 4 minutes. And then I got to, you know, juggle or something for 15 minutes. But I don't know. I've got some things I want to talk about. Mostly it's some of the stuff. Maybe I'll just play this podcast. I don't know. I mean, mostly it's about what he said, his music, and what he said in the lyrics to his music, and referencing the places that you can hear him growing. I mean, if you compare things like the early version of I Can Never Take the Place of Your Man and the bigger one, it's very similar, except there's a line in the beginning that says, but I'll try. And he doesn't do that in the other one, where it's like, right. Oh, you know, it's like, yeah, I'm not going to try, you know? And so you realize, you start to see things in his growth and his words that he reveals in ways that he didn't. One of the, and this is just me thinking of stuff off the top of my head. None of this may make the speech. I don't know. But he, I think it was somebody said, I want to say Susanna said that for a guy that didn't talk, this is how he communicated.
Right.
He communicated through his music and expressed himself through that in a way that's safe. You know, it's a very safe way to play, because all of a sudden he's a character, or this is a story told by this person. So I think that that's or just you don't realize he's actually throwing some shade at somebody. And, you know, he did that he threw shade at Morris. He threw shade at Jesse. He threw shade at St. Paul Peterson. He just, you know, he did that. I think it's important to understand context, that if he wrote a song about you or had you mention a song, you meant something to him in some form. You know, he doesn't just talk about anybody. CJ, he would record, talk about, you know.
Right.
And so you know that he was impacted by you if you got a reference to him in a song. And I think that I wanted to really play with that and go, you know, through a little bit of that. Wally is an important song because he trusted Wally. He was around Wally, and that's where he was like, you know. And so you hear some of the things he's saying in these songs where he's calling out. And it's so funny because we don't hear this stuff most of the time. And you listen to songs like If I Was Your Girlfriend. And at first people think, oh, that's a really nice song, If I Was Your Girlfriend. And then you start listening to the lyrics and you're like, whoa, 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 that's not nice at all. He's kind of saying, you know, would you run to me if somebody hurt you, even if that somebody was me? Well, wait, oh no. You know, he's expressing this stuff in a way that is authentic to him, but as an outsider, sometimes you may look at it and go, what? You know, what's the other song? A Big Tall Wall. Stone Circle, so you can't get out. That's what true love is about. I'm like, no, that's not what true love is about at all, actually. Putting somebody in a big, tall wall, a stone circle, not able to get out is not. In fact, it's just the opposite of what true love is about. You know, so that kind of stuff, you just go, oh, he's expressing this in his songs in a way, like I said, that's very authentic to him.
Right.
But it may be completely alien to us going, if I said that to my wife, I'm going to put you in a stone circle so you can't get out. She'd be like, no, I don't think so. So
she would be like Prince with the penguin. She would be like, don't even try it.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, that's exactly right. And you realize that the stories he's telling, you know, whether it's Dorothy Parker, where he probably had an affair and he's telling the story of the affair, or other things, you go, oh, he's just expressing what's in his. You got to imagine, this is a guy that is if you're going to be making this much music for, and you know, for the second book has The Flesh, Madhouse, Sheila, Family Stuff, stuff, several albums by him. What else? Jill Jones is in there. You get all these different layers of stuff in there, and you're going, he's got to write all this stuff. He's got to keep coming up with some. You, if you're a machine and you've got to do this, you got to feed the machine sometimes. So anything people say, a joke or anything, kind of goes into this machine and gets spit back out. It's where he is. If somebody says something, you know, he's on stage and starts singing Poor Goo, you know, that's a guy he works with, or things like that. This is, and that's not in the book, but that's a much later era, but you get the idea that this guy.
Yeah, or like Big Old Soul Sister.
Big Old Soul Sister. And I think, yeah, exactly. And you hear that and doing that live. He's like, Big Old Soul Sisters. And it's, there's a joy to what he's doing, but it's from here. It's, he, it almost right. like he doesn't have a filter when he's up on stage, and he's just saying stuff, and most of it is just so good because he's so good at this. But when you look back at some of the lyrics, you're going, "Whoa, what? Okay." I mean, I think it's just where he was, and his music was a diary at times, and I think that's an important thing. So that's pretty much what my talk is going to be about. If I can stretch that for 20 minutes, great. I may talk for 3 minutes and then do 25 minutes of questions. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's easier for me to answer questions than
well, that's great. I already got my ticket a couple of weeks ago, so.
Good.
So I'm set fun. Up. I'm ready it for fun. It. So
and there's some good people speaking too. There's some really good people
oh,
speaking.
Yeah.
So and yeah. like you said, the academia. I love listening to like D'Angela Duff. I love listening to her. Anil Dash. I love listening to it. There's certain people that you know. I love what they bring to the table with the research because they'll come up with things. Kanisa Williams.
Yes.
They will come up with things that I would never have thought of. And I'm going, oh my gosh, that is so profound. And, right. you know, I love, this is why I enjoy watching your interviews and stuff like this. The perspective you bring, just like Michael Dean or you know, Christopher Arnell or whoever it is, bring things to the table that right. I might not have gotten. And the questions, like I said, some of the questions you asked for Susan Rogers, I sat there going, oh my gosh, that's a question I wouldn't have thought of, and it made it in the book. If you look in the back of the book, you'll see I reference your stuff. So I make sure that, and the other thing is when I do quotes from other people, I want to make sure I share some love because
right.
you did the work. Why would I want to take credit for your work? I want to make sure everybody sees that, oh, okay, this is your work. I want to make sure here's the funny thing. If you make a quote with Susan Rogers and I got a quote from Susan Rogers and yours is better, I'm using yours. And I'm going to tell them at the end, I'm going to have a number there and they can go back in the book and they go, oh, Chris Johnson did this. Right. And here's the on YouTube where you can find that because I want people to not only look at what I said, go back to the original podcast and listen to it. And to me, that is important because what I'm able to do is give back to everybody who contributed to the book. And right. and so many times I see books that don't do that. And right. I'm like, where did they get this information from? They must have interviewed everybody. And I'm like, right. well, no. And so when I interview somebody, if I interviewed, you know, Peggy McCreary, I will say, Peggy says, or if I got a quote from her from somewhere in the past, I'll say, Peggy said.
Right.
Because I don't want to make it so that I really try not to take any credit for the work other people did because
right.
there's so much out there that people deserve some love and
right.
and I'm lucky enough to have been able to do a book, but if I can bring attention to you or other people who do great podcasts or great work, great, you know, blogs, I'm going to do that definitely because it can only yeah. make it better because we're in a period of so much good research, so much
yes.
Important research because we are no longer in the period of what Prince is going to do. It's what Prince has done. And it's sad. And it does break my heart saying that,
right.
but now we reflect on here's his body of work and we can look at it in context and we can start to analyze and build on what we know and expand on that. I mean, I prefer to him be playing. I expected him to be an elder statesman. This is when he passed, I thought, well, that doesn't make sense. He should be an 85-year-old guy bringing up some young, you know, guitarist saying, listen to this person jam, guy or girl or whoever. That's what you right. expected from him. And to not have that feels like the story never got finished.
Right, right.
And that's the thing to me is I feel like, wait, no, there's supposed to be another chapter in his right. story.
Right.
And so I kind of like everybody else that's missing him feel like, wait, there's something gone. With a book like this, I'm trying to give a chance to look at what we all experienced. And granted, you were a little young, a little pup, bit of a pup at yeah. the time. But having lived this in real time, and there's something about our generation, at least, you know, you have a period where you can look at him and say, I lived this in real time.
Right.
People coming up in the next generation aren't going to have that experience of getting an album, having a year to soak it in, and then going to the next one. And so I want people to see what he did in 2 years. And when right. you look at 700 freaking pages, that's a heavy book. It'll throw your back out.
Yeah.
You know, you can change a tire on your car with that underneath it. It's big. But It's a big book, but it is. I hope people look at it and go, you know, it doesn't seem like it's trying to be big. I actually had to cut 25,000 words out of it, and so
Wow.
that's the thing is you're going, oh my God. When I took it to the publisher, they said, well, you're supposed to deliver about 175 words. I'm like, I got 220. I got 250,000 words in here, and they're like, well, and I said, I'll get it down to 225. How's that? And they said, okay. But I'm like. And I realized most of the stuff I took out was, I don't say redundant, but things it covered. But it's still, there's so much to it. And I had somebody told me the other day, it was 700 pages and they still wanted more. And that made me laugh because I'm going, either you're a glutton or you want to make me suffer. One of the two. So.
Well, it's a tremendous book, and it's coming out June 10th from Roman and Littlefield Publishers.
Yes.
Go to roman.com to check
Yes.
them out. Also go to DwayneTudal.com to pre-order. And yeah, the link will be in the description box. Thank you for reminding me of that. The link will be in the description box. And to close this out, I just want to say that my next scheduled podcast is actually a review of the Son of the Times Super Deluxe Vault Tracks with Dreamy Pop Royalty, who's a friend of the show and been a co-host on a lot of the podcasts. We're probably going to do that as an audio podcast, so no video, unfortunately, but it will be uploaded to YouTube eventually. So I'm looking forward to that.
I am too. I'm looking forward to hearing that. I want to hear what you think of the album. I'm sure you thought it was okay, right?
It's perpetually tied at number two with Love Sexy in my personal canon
I get
of Prince favorites, Purple Rain being the number one, because that's just a completely flawless album front to back.
I get it.
So that'll be coming up here very soon. Son of the Times Super Deluxe Vault Tracks with Dreamy Pop Royalty. Looking very forward to that. Dwayne, I thank you so much for your time and your stories and your insights.
Thank you,
And I
Chris.
thank you so much for your friendship and your encouragement.
Of course, Chris, I'm looking forward to your book. I'm looking forward to talking again in 3 years. And thank you again for the review. It really you got one of the first reviews out there, and it means a lot to me. And good, let me explain to you to understand the context of that. I'm all about context. A good review makes the publisher understand what this book's about. Because I'll tell you, when I took it to the publisher, they didn't know what to do with it. They were going, I don't know how to publicize it. I'm telling you, there's a market for this. And they're like, well, okay. And it ended up being something they were really proud of. And they won some awards for it. And that makes me really happy. But good reviews on Amazon or other, other sites, Barnes and Noble, make it so that when people go to see those things, they see, okay, there's a lot of people that like this. Maybe I should read it. And that makes it so the next book is possible. And so when you write things like this, like what you wrote on that, I got choked up, man, because you really put your heart in that. And the funny thing was to me was watching how many people said what a great review it was. And they were complimenting you on your review. They're like reviewing your review. I would give Chris Johnson's review a 10, and I thought that to me was fun because it's like, yes, and I was part of that. And so your review meant a lot to me, and knowing how heartfelt and how it touched you. And that to me is pretty exciting. So I read every review, and I shouldn't, but I do. And it's nice when people connect to things, so thank you. Thank you. Sincerely, thank you.
Well, thank you so much. And I'll be in touch. I actually got an idea for a project to run past you. So,
Write me some night. I'm there.
okay. So that sounds good. Don't want to put more on your plate and overfill your plate, but
Okay.
just run something by you.
Please do. Please
And
do.
Okay, well, that's.
I've helped several people with the questions. I'm always open to people because again, I've told you before, a writer, a teacher is just somebody who's one step ahead of somebody. I've written a book, so if you want to write a book, maybe I can help machete some of the vines down for you and guide you a little bit. I'm happy to do that. Happy to do that. So.
Well, thank you so much again for your time. I appreciate it. I know my listeners and my viewers on YouTube appreciate it.
Thank you.
And the book is Prince and the Parade and Sign of the Times Era Studio Sessions, 1985 and 1986. It drops June 10th from Roman and Littlefield. And there you go. Go out and get this book. It'll be an experience to read for sure. So definitely pick it up. I would definitely recommend it. So thank you guys for listening. Thank you guys on YouTube for watching. We'll see you next time. I'm Chris Johnson, and I'm out.